Paul Sullivan writes the Wealth Matters column for the New York Times, and his articles have appeared in Fortune, Barron's, the International Herald, and Food and Wine. Today, he's here to discuss his book, The Thin Green Line, The Money Secrets of the Super Wealthy. Hey, Paul, first time have you on the show. Welcome.
Hey, Steve, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. You know, Paul, in a way, the title sounds like a get-rich-quick book, but of course, we know that's not the case. What is the main theme?
Yeah, the title is a way for people to think differently about the choices, decisions, and behaviors they're making around money. If listeners kind of visualize the line not as something that's horizontal or vertical, but as, say, you know, the S&P 500 returns over the past 50 years. Starts low, goes up and down a bit, but in the end, it's pretty high up there. And to me, being wealthy means you're on that side of that line where you're standing. Doesn't matter how much money you make. You could be, you know, toward the beginning and have a very modest income, or you could be, you know, toward the top and make a ton of money. But, you know, the corollary to that is, you know, those people who are on the wrong side of the line, who are either, you know, walking beneath it at the lower levels, who, you know, at the very top have, you know, all outward appearances of being, you know, very successful and rich at the house, the cars, the trips. But really, you know, they're living a house of cards. They're making bad decisions. They have bad behaviors around money. And essentially, you visualize them as the people who are either, you know, hanging on to that line with their fingertips or actually in free fall from that line, and they don't even know it.
Well, you're making a distinction between being wealthy and being rich. What is that distinction?
That is a distinction that, you know, if you're wealthy, you're going to be secure. You're going to control life. If you're rich, you may seem to have all the great things in life, but you're not that secure. You're not that financially secure. And at some point, life is going to control you. And, you know, I don't know about you, Steve, but I like to have choices in life, and I like to be able to at least control the things that I can control. And that's why I want to help people get on the wealthy side, the right side of the thin green line.
So wealth is really a psychological feeling, while rich is really a number. Can you illuminate the differences there too?
Absolutely. I mean, rich or poor, that's a number on a bank account statement. It's a number on a brokerage account statement. And, you know, as we saw in 2008, 2009, that number can change radically. And it's not something, you know, we can always control. I mean, the chapter I write on investing is called, you know, looking at stock quotes can be hazardous to your wealth. And the point of that is, you know, people who obsess about, you know, where the Dow is going to close, where the Nasdaq is going to close, chances are they're going to make bad decisions. They're going to buy when they shouldn't buy. They're going to sell when they shouldn't sell. I mean, this is human behavior. We've seen it time and time again. You know, what I try to do when I talk about, you know, wealthy, the people who, you know, it's more than a number, those are the people who have a sense of enough, whatever enough is going to be. It's not for me to say, you know, what is enough for one person may not be for another, but they're able to have, you know, do all the things they want to do in life and live, you know, at least financially, a life with far less stress than if they're just focused on that number. They're focused instead on those choices and those behaviors that they can control.
So can we simplify this and say the old Ben Franklin thing, let's say you have a dollar, it's 100 cents, and you have a penny more, you're happy. And if you have 99 cents, you're miserable. Or if you're living from paycheck to paycheck, this is not being on the right side of the green line.
Sure. And to be clear, you know, there are plenty of people living in very affluent towns who are living paycheck by paycheck. You know, to them, it may be, you know, bonus to bonus. The chapter on debt, I talk about this town in Connecticut called Darien, which is, you know, always rated as one of the top 10 wealthiest suburbs in America. And I kind of lay out this guy's sort of private financial life that was given to me confidentially. I lay out his life, and you see how he would seem, he's a high earner, you know, million, 2 million bucks a year. You'd think he has no problems. But the way he structured his financial life with debt around multiple homes, with spending, you know, all kinds of other things that are fantastic. And I wouldn't deprive anybody of any of these things, but he's living a house of cards. You know, in his example, I think it was, you know, if interest rates ticked up a percent or two, the debt payments would suddenly become onerous. He was living a life in which he thought the present and the future would look the same. And that is just not the reality. Yeah. One thing I guarantee, the future is going to look different than it does today.
Yeah, I think anybody with any life behind them knows that. You know, you're talking about the difference, and we saw a lot of individuals do this in 2006 and 2007 with their homes. they were getting these adjustable rate mortgages at below market rates. And it was all on the promise that, heck, the appreciation in your home was going to continue and you would be able to flip this home at some time in the future and make up for the deficit should even interest rates rise. And of course, that didn't happen. So in this case, you've got this person in Darien, Connecticut, who's living outwardly that beautiful lifestyle, but who knows what's really going on under the hood.
And you're right. And those interest-only adjustable rate mortgages, IOARMs, as they were called, they're just a vehicle. They're just a device. I mean, in theory, if you were the type of person who earned a salary throughout the year and then received some sort of sizable bonus at the end of the year, those mortgages might have made sense, but they'd only make sense if you had discipline. If you looked and you paid the interest all year long, and then at the end of the year, you paid down a big slug of the principal on your mortgage, great. It's a good cash management tool. Unfortunately, too many people didn't use them that way. They paid the interest, and when they got the bonus, they then bought a second home, or they, you know, took a wild vacation to Turks and Caicos, and they never touched the principal. Well, then they found that, you know, even $3 million houses fall in value. It's not just, you know, all those folks in Nevada and California that got pilloried during the housing crash. Expensive houses fall in value too. You know, your $3 million house can go down to, you know, $2.2 million. But if you only put $400,000 down, suddenly that $300 million house is underwater and you're in a real pickle, to use the technical term.
It's understanding, though, before you go in, I'll give you an example from your own book. You had mentioned that when you were looking for a home, the realtor showed you an 8,000 square foot home, and it was affordable kind of in a kind of a superficial way, right?
It was affordable in what I call a mortgage banker way.
Yeah.
When they ran all the numbers, they could say, you could afford this. And both my wife and I looked at each other and said, really? I don't know. How are we going to afford this? And we just, fortunately, we didn't feel comfortable. We didn't feel comfortable taking on that kind of debt and that kind of leverage. And, you know, we were fortunate for two reasons. I mean, 2008, 2009 happened, and that would have been very stressful to have had that giant mortgage payment. But we didn't know anything. You know, we were going into these sort of first-time home buyers, and we had no idea how much it cost to, you know, have an electrician over, have a plumber over, have somebody paint the house every 5 years, all of these other expenses that, you know, a mortgage broker is never going to tell you when you're buying a house. We were just totally ignorant of it. So we got lucky that we both have a pretty well-developed sense of enough and thought, you know, as beautiful as this house may be, I mean, I say in the book, it was, you know, right around the corner from David Letterman's old house. It was a nice neighborhood. As beautiful as it was, we didn't need it. But, you know, the book isn't about deprivation. I'm not telling people, you know, don't have this, don't do that. I'm telling people to make choices. So, you know, the house we're living in is great, and we love it. And it's a little bit smaller, but, you know, we're not all cramped into one room. So we're still doing okay.
Yeah, and the quality of life is better because you're not staying up at night worrying about, you know, the things that are out of your control, basically.
You're absolutely right.
Mm-hmm.
And when things go wrong, as any homeowner knows, when things go wrong, we're not worried about, you know, having a guy over to fix the boiler or even replacing the boiler. We've, you know, put that money aside, so we're not going to let life control us. We're going to have a bit of control over our life.
So that is an element of being on the right side of the thin green line. The book is The Thin Green Line, The Money Secrets of the Super Wealthy. The author is with me today, Paul Sullivan, and that's exactly what we are talking about. You know, in your book, you mention the term called financial therapy, which is a combination of psychology and financial advice. What do you think a person should expect from their financial advisor with regards to these issues?
Yeah, I mean, financial therapy, it's a real deep dive. And I think if more advisors could get trained up in this and more advisors were willing to take that dive with their clients, I think it would benefit everyone. I mean, in the book, I fly out to Kansas State, where they're doing a lot of really interesting research on sort of our underlying feelings about money. Essentially, we may say one thing, but I was sort of the guinea pig. They hooked me up to all kinds of sensors. You know, I was saying one thing, but all of the readings were showing another thing. You know, my fingers were getting sweaty. You know, my fingers were getting cold. It was the classic fight or flight response. And on the outside, I thought, hey, you know, I'm answering all these questions naturally, but I wasn't.
What were the questions? What were the questions?
They were basic questions. It was the exact questions that any advisor would, you know, ask their client. And all questions that not only did I have an answer for, but I thought, you know, my wife and I had handled well. It's just the basic, you know, construct of talking to your advisor can be stressful for a lot of people. But, you know, one of the things that the research out of Kansas State has shown that I think, you know, advisors and clients and everyone can benefit from is they're really trying to get people to understand themselves and their relationship to money. So there are people who suffer from money vigilance. What does that mean? That means, you know, they may be a little bit afraid of money and what money can do, and they're afraid to spend it. So they're actually on the other side. They're depriving themselves when they don't need to. But you also have people for whom, you know, money, their net worth equals their self-worth. You have other people who believe, you know, if only I had a bit more money, life would be better, or I'd be a better person. You know, both are equally untrue, but they try to get people to understand these things. And once somebody understands that, you know, hopefully they can have a better relationship with their advisor. I mean, how many times do advisors tell clients, you know what, you need to save X amount and spend Y and things will be fine. And the client goes off and says, yeah, I can do that. And, mm-hmm. and they do mm-hmm. for a couple months.
Right.
And then just like a diet, they fall off the wagon.
Yeah.
And they can't do it anymore because it's deprivation. It's not sort of, you know, understanding who you are as a person.
You know, we deal in these issues all the time. We especially deal in our community with a lot of people who live in fear because there's so many uncertainties out there with regards to politics or what's going on in countries or in the economy and so on. So there's a tendency to be more fearful than not. And they end up with having more than enough money and really, in a sense, sacrificing their own lives and the things that would make them more happy in that life or more contented out of fear. So one of the keys to addressing this is to quantify it. And you know, there are some wonderful tools out there that good investment advisors are using in order to quantify whether in fact you're going to be underfunded or overfunded or adequately funded for your retirement or for your goals. So once you get a sense of the quantification of these numbers, it goes a long way to helping you to counteract some of these four basic money scripts. You mentioned money vigilance. That's what I was just talking about. There's also one called money avoidance. Paul, tell us about that.
Yeah, it means you don't want anything to do with money. Money has become so freighted with emotions that you want to push it away. You're not going to negotiate for that higher raise. You're going to be very blasé about your savings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, money in my book, if I can stress it again and again, money is a means of exchange. The more money you have, the more things you can buy, the more options you have. The less money you have, the less things you can buy, the more cautious you have to be about your choices. That's it. I mean, too often, and particularly, you know, these folks with money avoidance, too often money becomes something more. Perhaps their parents fought over money. Perhaps their parents were divorced and they fought over money.
Well, how about the fact that maybe parents just never talked about it?
Or they never talked about it. Exactly. I mean, I see it, you know, today. Look, we wouldn't send our kids out into the world and not talk to them about drugs or sex. We'd be considered negligent parents if we didn't talk to them about drugs and sex. Why don't we talk to them about money?
It's taboo.
It's taboo.
Yeah.
It's fraught with risk. You think, oh, well, you know, nice people don't talk about money. Well, mm-hmm. how are kids going to learn if we don't teach them about money? I mean, we wouldn't throw our kids in a pool without a lesson. It's just not the sensible thing a parent should do. Yet, when it comes to money, I mean, I think part of the problem comes from a lot of couples don't talk openly enough
right.
about money. You know, the husband does one thing, the wife does another, and at the end of the month, they have a fight. Well, the kid sees that. That's going to make money something more than just a means of exchange.
Yeah, if the parents are not agreeing and can't come to some kind of consensus, they're surely not going to be able to turn around to the child and teach good values there either.
You're absolutely right. I mean, if, you know, parents realize that their kids are watching their every move when it comes to manners, when it comes to sitting at the table, when it comes to, you know, persistence in a task. You know, why would parents think that kids aren't watching their every move when it comes to money, when mm-hmm. it comes to the conversations they're having or not having, when it comes to how they spend or don't spend, you know, the stories they tell, the cars they drive. I mean, kids are watching every single thing. So if we're trying to model excellent behaviors in other aspects of our children's lives, we need to also model that behavior in their financial lives as
Very
well.
Interesting. So let's get back to these four scripts, because we've talked about vigilance. We've talked about status. The self-worth is linked to net worth. We've talked about money avoidance. And the final one here is money worship.
Sure. You know, money is the end-all, be-all. If I had that bigger house, my life would be better. If I could take my Toyota and turn it into a Mercedes, my life would be better. That's, you know, quintessential keeping up with the Joneses.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's a sucker's game. It's just not going to end well because, you know, there's all this research that shows when you buy things, you know, you need a suit to go to work. You need a couple suits. You need a couple shirts. You need a couple pairs of shoes because, you know, if that's what you wear to work, that's what you got to wear to work. But you don't need 20. You don't need 20 suits. You don't need 20 pairs of shoes. You don't need 40 shirts. At a certain point, the next shirt, the next pair of shoes doesn't matter. That's what money, you know, worship becomes. These people are going to find out when they go from that 2,000 square foot house to the 4, to the 6, to the 10, to the 15,000 square foot house, it's never going to fulfill them. They're worshiping something that is a false idol, as it were.
Many of those who have attained great wealth through business creation or investing, it's really never been about the money. The money is basically a scorecard for them. It's a result of the work that says, yes, you're doing this work correctly. I mean, the poster child for this would be a Warren Buffett, who still lives in the same house he lived when he was first married. You know, this is a guy who could buy countries left and right. And you interviewed a lot of wealthy people. I mean, I'm sure some of them viewed wealth as part of their self-worth, but did you find a lot didn't as well?
Yeah, I mean, those who would find it as part of their self-worth, I wouldn't call them wealthy. I'd call them rich because they have the wrong mindset around money. But, you know, I agree totally with what you said, that for many of these people, you know, the money just kind of came. They were myopically focused on whatever it was they wanted to do, whatever job they were doing, whatever company they were running. And at a certain point, they raised their head and they realized, geez, I've accumulated a bunch of wealth. I mean, for a different generation, I think of my grandparents' generation, this is what happened with their homes. And you know, my parents' generation, to some extent, this is what happened with their homes. They bought a house and they lived in it for 30 years. And when they went to sell it, they said, geez, how did that happen? It is worth, you know, some multiple, 4 or 5 times of what I paid for it. You know, we kind of got off that track in, you know, the early 2000s where the home became an ATM. I think most of the super wealthy, you know, still had that mentality of the home being just something that was there. The home was their company and it just kept building up, building up, building up. At a certain point, they sold it and they said, wow, I've really accumulated some wealth here.
Well said. Unfortunately, we are out of time. The purpose of this discussion is to help our listeners figure out how to get on the right side of that thin green line. And that, in fact, is the name of the book, The Thin Green Line, Money Secrets of the Super Wealthy. My guest, Paul Sullivan. Hey, Paul, first time talking to you. It's great. Thank you so much for your book and your information.
Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.